You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is James Corbett, publisher of theCorbettReport.com and editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He's speaking to us from Japan. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to be here.
Japan just had two serious earthquakes. How bad and how's the recovery?
They were pretty bad, and they affected, they certainly affected the population on Kyushu, the island in the southwest portion of Japan. And they were quite strong, and they were quite near, the epicenters were quite inland. So that definitely made a difference. People felt the shocks. It has displaced a number of people, and things are not very good for the people that it displaced. In fact, I was just reading some reports that the survivors are suffering to a large degree from quote-unquote economy class syndrome, which I guess applies to people who have been cooped up in a plane for too long. But these people have been cooped up in their emergency shelters for too long, worrying about the next quake and whether it might be sending their roof down on their heads. So definitely still a dire situation for a lot of people who are still living in evacuation centers.
Yes, because we haven't heard a lot about it. The Ecuadorian earthquake, I guess, being much larger, has got all the headlines.
That's right. I mean, it is interesting the way these things are portrayed in the media. Sometimes they do tend to get a lot of attention and other times not. Sometimes it has to do not only with the size of the quake, but where it's located and how far away from major urban centers and that sort of thing. So that might be a factor in this. I haven't seen a lot of reporting on the Ecuadorian quake, so I don't really know, you know, to what extent people were affected there.
Taking a look at finances, is Japan going to lower its already negative interest rates?
There is no indication that they are going to do that yet, but then again, there was no indication they were going to do that in the first place. But I think that there's no indication that the negative interest rate has had any positive effect on the economy at this point, so I'm not sure that it's even an attractive option to the central bank, would-be planners of the universe, including, of course, Prime Minister Abe and Haruhiko Koda at the Bank of Japan. So it looks like what they're going to turn to is, instead of cutting rates, they're going to turn to more stimulus. This time, instead of stimulus in a general sense, instead of buying up treasuries or things of that nature, apparently they're going to, at least they're now toying with the idea of shopping vouchers given directly to households in what they are calling, quote, a redistribution of wealth, end quote, that they are hoping is going to stimulate the retail spending, which will get the economy moving again. I'll believe it when I see it, but at any rate, it is at least a more direct approach than what we've seen before. But as I'm reading an article here from Reuters talking about this new idea that's being proposed by Abe's government, and BNP Paribas Securities commentator Hiroshi Shiraishi seems to get it right. He says, raising wages is the right thing to do, but this will not impact economic growth. Households are unlikely to spend extra money when they're worried about the future, especially when they know the handouts are being financed by government debt. So I think that's really the crux of this issue. They can hand out money on a silver platter, but people are still in a save every scrap of paper or yen that comes across their plate mode, because right now people are very concerned about the state of the economy. And until that really does start to turn around, people aren't going to change that mindset. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg question of how you start reflating in that type of environment.
Well, I'm sure the intent of a retail voucher is they have to buy a physical object, but you know, anything of value can be traded for cash, can't it?
Well, that's a good point. Yes, that's exactly right. But again, I think the point here is that people are, yeah, exactly, they're going to want to try to either hoard or just convert into cash and hoard the cash. And I think that's the mindset that most people are in right now, because they are very concerned about the future. And there has been a bit of an uptake in real wages here in the last few months or for a couple of quarters. But still, over the long term, the real wages continue to decline, as basically people can't keep up with the stagnant economy here. And a lot of people who are treading water are starting to sink under that water.
Well, those 1% and 2% pay raises that have been in favor the last 15 years, they'll tell you, well, that's the inflation rate. But we know they don't include energy and housing in inflation. How is that supposed to keep you going?
That's right. And of course, every government has its own way of doing jiggery pokery with their inflation numbers. Japan has its own CPI, but it's the same It's the same deal. For the important key factors, of course, they're not included in the official inflation rates. So they're looking at this point. I mean, Japan has been in a deflationary cycle for a very long time, but really, so have wages, unfortunately. So a lot of people are still continuing to either get along with the salary they had before, or even taking pay cuts in order to survive. And that's definitely affecting their ability to survive in the economy overall.
What about China's economy? Are they going to recover, or are they in a tailspin?
They are not in a tailspin, but I wouldn't call it a recovery. It's an interesting phenomenon that's taking place right now. And they're touting all this new economic data that's talking about a rebound. And I believe we talked about it last time I was on the program, that basically they looked at year-on-year results for March were starting to come out, and they were showing a great rebound. Yay, that there's been this great uptick since last year. But that didn't take into account the fact that the Chinese Lunar New Year fell on a different date, and that affected the holidays, which affected who was working and what was going on in the economy at that time. And the way that that happened between 2015 and 2016 skewed the numbers, so it looked like there was an increase in economic activity in 2016, but that was only because the holidays fell on different dates. So a lot, we have a lot of that kind of nonsense going on that's trying to make this look like there's really an economic rebound going on. And the latest that I've seen is the National Bureau of Statistics in China just released the March industrial profits, and they are showing 11.1% rise to $86.5 billion in March, which is the strongest number since July 2014. So again, there are outlets that are championing this news as a sign that there's, you know, everything's going swimmingly in the Chinese economy. But counter that with another story that came across the headlines today, where China's Statistics Bureau is being called out for profiting from data. And it says that the Chinese Communist Party anti-graft watchdog said on Wednesday that hundreds of staff working for the country's Statistics Bureau have been using data for personal gain, including collecting fees for providing information and other services. So chalk that up to the lengthy list of problems with China's Statistics Bureau, including the fact that even the vice premier of the country has admitted in the past, privately in documents that were leaked via WikiLeaks, but still admitted in the past that they cook the numbers and that he doesn't trust the GDP data that comes from his own Statistics Bureau. So I think we can take all of that news with a grain of salt, but then quadruple that or quintuple that with the latest data that shows, I think, what's really happening here is that debt has now reached a record high in China, and that is fundamentally what is underlying any sort of uptick in economic activity that's taken place in recent months. Debt levels are now 237% of GDP, the record high levels. And I think that's only going to increase as China really only has the ability to flood more liquidity into the markets to try to get them to try to get the economy moving. And I think that's the only trick they have up their sleeve at this point.
What about China's effort to buy as much gold as they can? Do they fear that their paper currency will be devalued to the point they'll have to back it with gold?
Yes, I think there is a concern about what's happening with the yuan and its ability to handle the likely or the, at least the potential future devaluations that are going to be needed to get it where it needs to be in terms of its parity or its relationship with the dollar. And a lot of people are worried about that, and a lot of people are worried that the Chinese government won't be able to backstop what's going on in their economy with all this debt. So surely, I mean, as thousands of years of history has shown, gold is the traditional way to, at the very least, assure the markets that, yes, we have enough in reserve to take care of what's going on here. Don't worry, we've got it covered. And China cannot be accused of having slouched in the gold buying department over the last several years. They continue to be, obviously, a net importer of gold. We've seen record levels of capital outflows specifically towards purchasing gold mining operations around the world or investing in gold mining stocks around the world. So there's that investment going on. And just in the last couple of weeks, we saw the launch of a new China gold fix, the new yuan-denominated gold fix to rival the London Bullion Market Association's gold fix, which is what is generally used for the spot price of gold. It comes from the LBMA. Well, China is starting their own rival to that, and it uses a similar process of simulated trading amongst some banks, but these are Chinese banks doing the trading, and the trading is in yuan. So there is now a yuan spot gold price, and I think all of these are signs that obviously gold is an important part of what's happening in China, and they're not neglecting that. As their economy slows down, I think they're trying to show that they can backstop that with something tangible.
James, a lot of Canadians think Justin Trudeau has put Canada back on the international stage. GQ just named him one of the best-dressed people in the world, and the only politician on their best-dressed list. Is Justin really gathering international headlines?
I've certainly seen him coming up in that context, but in fact, a lot of the stories I've seen about that are from Canadian outlets saying, look, he's so popular overseas, so take that for what it's worth. I think at least a lot of people have heard his name at this point and seen his face, so I guess that's something, but I don't really understand if that's supposed to be the end goal of international diplomacy, really, just to have people recognize who your prime minister is. I guess it's a start, but it doesn't really do a whole lot for Canada, I think. And obviously the more important question is, how is he representing Canada and what kinds of policies is he enacting? And on that front, I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot to be excited for.
How much attention is being paid to the Trump-Clinton battle in Japan?
There is some attention on it, if only because Trump has made some pretty provocative comments about the potential changes to the U.S.-Japan security relationship. I think not a lot of people at the political level are taking those comments seriously because they think that this is a 60-year relationship and U.S. and Japan are tied at the hip and nothing is fundamentally going to change. But at least people are commenting on that type of rhetoric and how it can be potentially a very disruptive thing in the Asia-Pacific, which of course is becoming more of a tinderbox as we see the rise of China economically and militarily, and it's starting to flex a bit of its might in the East China Sea, Japan scrambling more jets in the last few months than they have in years to try to intercept Chinese craft coming into Japanese airspace and that sort of thing. So there is definitely an increase in tensions over here. So when you have Trump coming out and saying, well, Japan and South Korea, they can make their own nukes and that kind of thing, that's a hugely important situation that that could, I mean, if it was implemented, would vastly change the security environment here in the Asia Pacific. So people are interested in that. On the everyday, day-to-day level, I'm sure there aren't a lot of people here who would even be able to recognize Donald Trump, but there are some, and I've even seen there's a YouTuber here who has made a bit of a splash, at least amongst the foreigners here in Japan, in being very pro-Trump. But that's seen as kind of an odd position for a Japanese person to take at this point. So that's the extent to which this is being followed, and I don't think, you know, Japan has a hugely strong opinion on this either way.
Energy prices really affected by the world price of oil?
Yes, of course. I mean, obviously, that's one of the fundamental underpinnings of the entire energy market. So as goes the price of oil, so goes the energy markets, generally speaking. But we may start seeing a decoupling in that relationship in the coming decades, especially because with the Paris Climate Treaty having been officially formally signed in New York last week, we are now living in what is expected to become a post-carbon world. How exactly they're actually going to implement that remains to be seen. But at any rate, as I've talked about before, there's $90 trillion of potential energy infrastructure investments on the table between now and 2030 that are going to be directed one way or another, and it looks like they're going to be increasingly directed away from oil and towards other potential forms of energy. So I think we may start to see a decoupling in that. But at the moment, of course, still the energy markets very much depend on the price of oil. And oil is doing better than a lot of people thought, but still, obviously, nowhere near where it was a couple of years ago.
Well, the demand for gasoline in China continues to climb. For some reason, they're in love with SUVs, probably the same reason the rest of us are. You can see over the rest of traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of the same dynamics work. And yes, this is something important to keep in mind. I mean, the Chinese economic dragon is not what it used to be, but still, we have a lot more people now who are at least getting in towards what we would think of as middle class lifestyle. And that is going to mean millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions more people eventually getting into the market for things like vehicles. That's obviously already been quite a problem in the major urban centers like Beijing, where you have to enter a lottery in order to be eligible to buy a car, and then you can only drive your car on certain days of the week and things of that nature. But still, there are more and more car owners in China and more coming online every day. So that is changing the calculus for. For example, I mean, a couple of years ago, China became the largest oil importer on the planet. And that's an important shift, and one that countries like Saudi Arabia, I think, are taking a look at and starting to reevaluate the necessity of their close, wedded at the hip alliance with the United States.
Well, Saudi Arabia now has just announced it's trying to wean itself off oil and is going to try to go high tech and develop alternative energy. And of course, they have loads of solar.
Yes, that's true. No lack of that in the desert. For people who don't know, they're starting to initiate a process to do an IPO on Saudi Aramco, the state-owned oil company, and they are expected to sell less than 5% share in Aramco, and from that, they're expected to generate over $2 trillion. That is a pretty big nest egg to be playing with, and I think this is one of the main options on the table for the Saudi regime right now, because really the Saudi government exists because of oil revenues. They buy off their population and everything else that they need with the oil revenues. But oil revenues obviously have fallen off a cliff in the last couple of years and has given them a taste of what a post-carbon future might look like if that indeed does come to pass. I think the writing's on the wall, and the Saudis realize they need to have some other form in order to maintain power. So I think they're just looking after their own self-interest. It remains to be seen whether they'll be able to fruitfully convert that $2 trillion nest egg into something productive and actually generate some new economic industries there. But it's I don't think they have an alternative.
I don't know if they'll have too many people who are actually Saudis working in their plants either, because they get a national income.
Yes, that's right. And again, that has been enabled by the oil revenues. So when your public gets accustomed to that sort of lifestyle, you can't really easily turn off that spigot. You can't suddenly wrench it into reverse and say, well, okay, now everyone's going to have to work a little bit harder and tighten their belts. That'll work to a certain extent, but after a certain point, people will just revolt. And I think that's very much what the Saudi government has on its mind.
And when people question, what, free money? In Alaska, half of the oil royalties raised by the state go directly to citizens.
It's not an unusual thing. Norway, for example, has a large nest egg that it's created from its oil deposits and gas deposits in the North Sea. And the Alberta government used to have its rainy day fund, but obviously that's being depleted at this point, and Alberta is not what it used to be. But obviously a lot of oil producer nations have had that access to wealth and have in one way or another tried to convert it into largesse for the public. And we see how that has worked out in places like Venezuela, which has now reached the absurd proportion of not having enough money to print more money. But as things collapse in Venezuela, I think we start to see where things go if a government with that kind of oil revenue doesn't use it on something meaningful and create meaningful economic infrastructure.
Well, I heard there was a shortage of toilet paper in Venezuela, but I didn't hear about the shortage of paper money.
It's insane. It's happening right now. Zero Hedge, for example, is covering it right now. It's on the front page. Venezuela runs out of money to print new money. And one of the effects of the runaway inflation that's happening in Venezuela right now is that they're desperately trying to get their hands on as many bolivar as they can, their own currency, just so that they can flood that liquidity back into the markets and maintain this inflation that's happening right now. And so far, they've imported 5 billion banknotes from around the world so that they can put that in the hands of the people, and more banknotes are being needed to purchase less and less. And that's exactly how these types of bubbles tend to die, especially in a country that has had incredible amounts of oil wealth over the last several years or couple of decades, really, and has not productively used that in a way that would create a net for them once that comes to an end.
James, thank you very much for chatting with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
My guest has been James Corbett, publisher of thecorbettreport.com and editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He was speaking to us from Japan. You're listening to the HouseStreet.com radio show. Find us on Twitter at Talk Digital Net. Our popular YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Comments can be sent to info@HouseStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thanks for listening.